So tonight we're going to continue our discussion where we began a discussion several weeks ago looking at the church and looking at God establishing his expectations for the church. And we've been talking about how God reveals those expectations to us. So we started last week to talk about three different ways that God can express his expectations. One is a precept, or sometimes it's worded in the form of a commandment. Sometimes it's not necessarily worded like a command or a demand that we do a certain thing, but it instead is a precept. And so that's the first way that God could speak to us, and that's pretty easy to understand. And then God also speaks to us using examples. And those examples tell us what we can do that will be acceptable as far as God is concerned. Tonight we're going to continue that discussion of examples. And I wish I could say that I was smart enough that I thought this up, that I came up with this organization. I didn't. This is an organization that, as far as the discussion of examples is concerned, is adapted from some work that was done by Roy Cogdell in a real small book with very tiny print, called Walking by Faith. And we have several copies in the library here if you're interested and you would like to review the material that Cogdell wrote. This is lesson five in his book, and it just so happens that this is labeled church number five in my analysis. So let's think about examples for a minute. He says there are several things that we have to think about when we think about examples and whether or not those examples speak to us with authority. The first thing that he describes is something he calls the rule of harmony, or sometimes it's referred to as the law of harmony. I don't think that Roy Cogdell was the only one who had proceeded down this line of analysis. Some people call it a law of harmony, some people call it a rule of harmony. But basically, this rule of harmony says an example of first century Christians under the guidance of the apostles doing something speaks to us with authority. When there's a precept that describes the example, and when that example is understood in harmony with that precept. So let me say it this way. Particular statements in Scripture, whether they're stating a precept or describing an example, must be understood in light of the totality of the Scripture. And I'll give you an example of that. The short bumper sticker version of that is truth is always in harmony with truth. And the Apostle Paul used that principle when he talked to the Corinthians about his authority and him speaking authoritatively using precepts. He said, if any man thinks himself to be a prophet or spiritual, let him acknowledge that the things that I write unto you are truth, and we know that no lie is of the truth. You're not going to find truth contradicting truth, at least the right understanding of truth contradicting the right understanding of truth. Now, sometimes it might look like there's a contradiction, and we'll talk about that a little bit. An example of a church doing a certain thing would violate a precept that might be stated in another place. And this is the this is the example that I want us to look at, because it, I think it helps us to understand this law of harmony. So we're going to look at Acts, the 11th chapter. And this is a case where the church sent relief to the elders in Judea because there was a famine in Judea. Okay? So here's Acts 11, and I'm going to begin reading at verse 27. It says, now in those days, prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them, named Agabus, stood up and foretold by the Spirit that there would be a great famine over all the world. This took place in the days of Claudius. So the disciples determined, everyone according to his ability, to send relief to the brothers living in Judea. They did so, sending it to the elders by the hand of Barnabas and Saul. We're familiar with that. Some would suggest that because they sent it to the elders, that the elders that they sent it to were over all of the churches in Judea. And there were more than one church. There was more than one church in Judea, right? So we have to remember that after Jerusalem, the gospel began to spread, and there were churches throughout Judea. It wasn't just the church in Jerusalem. Now, I think the church in Jerusalem was probably included in this, but some people have argued that because the apostles took the money to the elders, that there was a group of elders that was overseeing all of the churches in Judea that had need. Yeah, Bill.
To me, it's just as easy to conjecture they sent to the elders at each church.
Okay.
Individually.
Okay. And that's the point that I'm trying to make. Now, if I conclude that that was the case, then I don't violate a precept that's stated somewhere else that elders oversaw a particular flock that was among them. That's 1 Peter 5 at verse 2. The elders which are among you I exhort, who have also an elder, to feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof. So elders were over the flock that was among them. This is not a case, if we understand it properly, this is not a case where one group of elders oversaw multiple churches. Now that's a principle of organization that developed during the second and third centuries. Yeah, Bill.
At that time, was the church there still hiding underground?
I think I would say yes.
Well,
but I think I would say yes, that this was still during the time of persecution, but I would actually need to go back and research that to make sure. Because remember, with the Christians in Judea, there was persecution that rose. Many of the Christians left, along with Aquila and Priscilla. Okay, they went to Corinth, and then that persecution died down. Many of the Christians came back to Jerusalem. Then the persecution started again in the late 70s and 90s, and really reached a crescendo in the 90s. And then it died down again. So, yeah, I think this is during that period between the two persecutions, when they were not, well, I shouldn't say. I just need to be certain of that. Yeah.
Okay, I have a point. If that was the case, and the church was divided into little groups here and there, under one group of elders, it was a single church in little pieces. There wouldn't be anything wrong with that.
Yeah, that was something else that I encountered when I was looking at this example, that there were, for want of a better term, there were house churches that were meeting individually throughout Jerusalem, but the whole church as a whole was under the leadership of the elders. I can't find that described anywhere, but that is something that has been talked about so frequently that a lot of people just accept that as the case. And I'm not sure that that's the case.
Yeah.
Is that help? Does that... excuse me, does that explain what Bill is talking about with these house churches, where the church in Jerusalem, shortly after its founding, was about 5,000, and we know that there weren't very many municipal buildings or public buildings that would hold 5,000 men, plus their wives, plus their families, if they gathered together. And so they probably met in separate little clumps throughout the city. And then you have some indication when the apostle talks to the Corinthians about the whole church coming together to exercise some discipline. So that may be a case where all of these house churches, the separate meetings that they were having, came together as a whole, and the elders oversaw that whole, so they would be involved with these smaller groups that were meeting as well. So, again, I don't find that described anywhere. It seems plausible, but I just don't find it described. So,
you're absolutely right. I mean, there's question. There's also the matter that all the little groups made probably didn't have men qualified to be elders.
Well, that happened fairly quickly in the history of the church, because most of the people that were involved in the early church, we're talking, you know, right after Jerusalem, most of those people came out of Judaism. Okay, so they were familiar with the scriptures. It wasn't like we were converting people off the street who had no relationship or no knowledge of the scriptures and hadn't had much experience with God. These were people that had an experience with God. And if we're right, the New Testament is the fulfillment of the Old. So you develop the maturity in the understanding of the New Testament much more quickly than we would if I went out and just converted some. I'm just picking on Dylan. When we converted Dylan, he had no background in biblical knowledge. So for him to come to a level of maturity where he's going to function as an elder, that would take a while. But these people had a head start in a sense. So when the apostle and Barnabas went on their second missionary journey, it says that in Acts 14 at verse 23, they appointed elders in every church. So it wouldn't be surprising that they would find people who hadn't been baptized all that long ago, but had a long background with God. Yeah, Carol.
Yeah, And it's not that they had the knowledge that that God gave them from the Old Testament. It's their character, the qualities of good character, the having a good wife, the not having believing children, so forth. So those qualities were ones that they strived for under the old law, but because they were given special miracles and talents and understanding, the elders could understand through the direction of the Holy Spirit what was right and what wasn't right.
And in some cases, you're right. In some cases, you're right, but not in every case. That having been given a special dispensation of the Spirit through the laying on of the apostles' hands was not mentioned as a quality of elders. Now, many of them did have that quality, did have that ability, but that's not a qualification. But like you said, they had a long experience with these qualities, and that came from their experience with the Old Testament. So, yeah. Now, I don't find this concept of the church in Jerusalem being divided up into house churches, but I do find that there were multiple churches in Judea. And that too makes sense. It wasn't like they had an interstate system and you could hop on the interstate and you could go 30 miles in just a very few minutes. If you went from Jerusalem to Bethany, you had, or to Bethlehem, you had to walk. That was 12 miles. Okay, so there was probably a church in Bethlehem. I don't know that for sure. But it's like if you go back to the south where I grew up, you find all of these little country churches, and that's because people walk to go to church. And so you'd have all these little country churches around and these little buildings the name of the meeting house escapes me now, but it's a really famous meeting house. And that little building only seats like 40 people. So famous church, did a lot of stuff, really small. So you would have these little churches, but they're churches. They're not house churches that were a part of the Jerusalem church. They were churches on their own. And they functioned on their own. Yeah.
They were autonomous.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. They were churches in their own right. They were autonomous churches. And I think I'm kind of like Bill. If there were multiple churches in Judea, then the way that I would understand this example is to say the money was sent by the hands of Paul and some people that were appointed to travel with him to provide for things honest. And they took that money and they gave it to the elders in Judea in the different churches where there was a need. So to say that they gave it to the elders is entirely appropriate. Just don't think they gave it to one group of elders. So this is a principle of harmony. You can't take a statement in an example and divorce it from the information that we have available in the rest of the Bible. It doesn't work that way. We have to take the Bible as a whole. Comments, thoughts. See, I think this is a really important concept that we understand a particular statement in terms of the larger context, Bible as a whole. And you're not going to get an example that violates a precept. It just won't happen. Okay. Anyway, now let's talk about another rule that's important when we think about examples speaking authoritatively, either to tell us that we must do something or we must not do something. The New Testament sometimes records examples that include incidental information. And that incidental information shouldn't be understood authoritatively. It's just incidental to the example. Let me give you an example of this. Acts the 16th chapter, beginning at verse 11. This is when the apostle is in Philippi, and first time that the gospel is preached in Philippi, he preaches to a group of women that had gathered by a river to pray. Somebody want to read that? Acts 11 verses, or Acts 16 verses 11 through 15.
From Troas we put out to sea and sailed straight for Samothrace. And the next day we went on to Neapolis. From there we traveled to Philippi, a Roman colony and the leading city of that district of Macedonia, and we stayed there several days. On the Sabbath, we went outside the city gate to the river where we expected to find a place of prayer. We sat down and began to speak to the women who had gathered there. One of those listening was a woman from the city of Thyatira named Lydia, a dealer in purple cloth. She was a worshiper of God. The Lord opened her heart to respond to Paul's message. When she and the members of her household were baptized, she invited us to her home. If you consider me a believer in the Lord, she said, come and stay at my house, and she persuaded us.
Okay, so what do you see as critical information here, and what do you see as just incidental information? Kind of some things that happened that surround the critical things. Yeah, Carol.
A place to meet or to gather together.
Okay. Is that incidental or is it critical?
It's critical, but the river isn't critical.
What part of that is critical?
The fact that you have to have a place where you can gather together.
Oh, okay. Okay. So they, it was a gathering and they had a place.
And they were looking for spiritual things. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But by the riverside, that's just an incidental. That's probably, I mean, if I've never been to that part of the world. I don't know anything about that part of the world. But I'm guessing that along the river is where you're going to find some flat places where people could gather together to pray. You know, especially if it's a mountainous region. Yeah.
More critical than that is the preaching of the word.
Okay. Okay. Is it critical that it was an apostle?
No.
No, it was an apostle, but in my mind doesn't appear to be critical information. It was an assembly of women. Is that critical or is that incidental?
Incidental.
Okay. I'm with you. I think that's incidental. I don't think that they assembled in single-sex assemblies. Now, the Jews did that. When the Jews assembled, they came into the synagogue, and the men sat on one side, the women sat on the other side. There was a curtain down the middle, and if you were a Pharisee, you never touched a woman. You would hold out a handkerchief, and the woman would hold the end of the handkerchief, so you never touched the woman. So they had single-sex assembly, but I think that's just an incidental. Yeah.
Baptism was taught.
Okay.
And to us, that's a necessary thing. And that seems that was a necessary part of the message.
Okay. Okay. How do you know it was a part of the message?
Because she was baptized in her household.
Okay. She responded to it. So that's a critical part of the message. Yeah. A critical part of this example. It was on the Sabbath day. Critical or incidental?
At the time, it was critical. That was when it was preached.
Okay.
It was the supposed time for meeting by the apostles.
Well, it was critical in that they wanted to find people that got together to talk about spiritual things. And so they did that on the Sabbath day. But it was incidental that they met on the Sabbath day. Yeah.
Well, you have lots of examples of the men going to preach in the synagogue.
That's
and
true.
The reason that you go to the synagogue or to the river is because that's where people who are interested in your message are gathering and on that day. So it's not critical. It happens to be the best time in this time.
Yeah, it was true that that's what happened, but it was an incidental. It didn't have anything to do with the critical nature of what was going on. It was just an incidental. Okay? Look at another example. This one is in Acts 20. And this is the church in Troas, where the Apostle Paul has gathered with them because they came together to take the supper. And Paul preached. Somebody want to read Acts 20, verse 7 through 11?
And upon the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul discoursed with them, intending to depart from tomorrow, and prolonged his speech until midnight. There were many lights in the upper chamber where we were gathered together. There sat in the window a certain young man named Eutychus, borne down by deep sleep. As Paul discoursed yet longer, being borne down by his sleep, he fell down from the third story and was taken up dead. And Paul went down and fell on him and embraced him, said, "Make ye no ado, for his life is in him." And when he was gone up and had broken bread and eaten and had talked with them a long while, even till break of day, so he departed. And he brought the lad; they brought the lad alive and were not a little comforted.
Okay. So what are the critical aspects of this? And what are the incidental aspects of this example?
It was the first day of the week when they gathered to break bread.
Okay.
And they broke bread.
Is that critical or incidental?
Yes, critical.
Okay, critical. What makes you think that it's critical that it was the first day of the week?
Well, I don't know the English parts of speech.
First day of the week.
But when we gathered together for the purpose of breaking the bread.
Okay. That was their purpose. Absolutely.
That
but what about the first day of the week? Remember, we talked about this last week. Paul is in a hurry to get to Jerusalem. He gets to Troas and he stays for 7 days. So if he was in such a hurry, how come they didn't just go ahead and eat the supper on Monday so he could get on his road, on his way to Jerusalem to be there for the feast? Apparently, it was critical that it be on the first day of the week. So they waited 7 days. He got there on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. He stayed there for 7 days to be there on a Sunday. Yeah, Bill.
I have a question. It's been my understanding all along that the reason we have the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week is because it's the day Jesus rose from the grave. And I'm thinking that was critical.
That's an assumption as far as I see it. I don't find any biblical statement about that being the day. we don't take it on the first day of the week because that's the day Jesus rose from the dead. I can't find that anywhere. It is true, but it may be an incidental that gets elevated to the idea of critical without biblical warrant. Yeah, it might be. And like I say, it is true that Jesus rose on Sunday, and it is true that that's the day that the church was established on Pentecost. First gospel sermon was preached. That is true, but I don't know that it's critical. And as far as that being the day that Jesus rose from the dead. Okay, it makes sense that they would want to be aware of the resurrection on that day, but I don't find it commanded anywhere. I just don't find a precept like that. Other comments. What about the fact that they gathered in an upper room?
Nope, that's incidental.
Okay.
They could gather anywhere. They could gather by the river.
Okay, they gathered. And that helps us because now we see one time they gathered down by a river. They weren't even in a building. This time they gathered in an upper room and Eutychus fell out the window. Okay. They were on the third floor. There were churches that concluded that the idea of an upper room was critical, and so churches were always built with a basement. So that the upper room was where they assembled to take the Lord's Supper. Yeah.
Does that mean they also had an open window and always had somebody sitting there calling out?
Well, yeah. You have to remember, this is those little country churches throughout Kentucky and Tennessee and Missouri. And, yeah, they always had open windows because they didn't have air conditioning back then.
But did you have somebody volunteer to fall out of the window?
I don't know about that, But they always had a funny story. We were worshiping in one of those little churches like that, and the window was open, and a bee flew in and landed on Mandy's neck. Okay. So there's this bee walking around on Mandy's neck, and I grabbed my handkerchief and reached out and swatted and grabbed that bee and walked over to the window and threw the bee out the window, and everybody clapped. I was a hero for one day because I saved my daughter from getting stung. But yeah, you just need to be aware of the difference between critical and incidental. And it's true, in every case where people were baptized, they were baptized in a naturally occurring body of water, probably. At least in those cases where it's specified, it was a naturally occurring body of water. But I don't think that's critical. Now, the Jews did believe that it was a mikvah, a Jewish baptistry, had to be a naturally flowing body of water. It could be a hole that you dug, but it had to be filled by water that naturally flowed into that mikvah and then naturally flowed out of it. And do you know, again, little churches, rural churches in Kentucky, that's why they always have a picture of a flowing stream behind the baptistry. Yeah.
In the old law, it mentions in different places things are to be done with living water.
Yeah, that's why they did it.
Which can also be poured, I believe.
Yeah, that's why they did it, was it had to be living water. I think that's mistaking the notion of critical and incidental in the New Testament.
There are people I know that I remember there was somebody that Jerry baptized that wanted to be baptized in this ice cold stream over in Central Oregon. And it was colder than anyway, it was living water.
Yep.
And it was a person's prerogative that wanted to be baptized, and it was water.
Yep.
So it was fine.
I may conclude that that's an incidental, but if somebody wanted to be baptized in living water, I'd do it.
We've had a couple that do that lately.
Yes, we have.
Which is very unusual here.
Yes, we have. But we have water in our baptistry now, by the way. I don't think you can you guys hear the pump running?
I can.
I can, because my hearing aid picks up metallic sounds. Huh. So I can hear that pump running. Yeah. We'll once we get some more work done, we'll be able to keep that from happening. Yeah.
I just think about the living water. It's water that's flowing. But if you think about the Dead Sea is not living water, and the contrast between the two, besides just moving, is one is dead and one's alive. It's moving. It's fulfilling a purpose.
Yeah. Now, in the case of the eunuch in Acts 8, I have no idea whether that was flowing water or not. It might have been a stock pond. He just said, see, here's water. What hinders me to be baptized? So I don't know what it was in that case. But in every case where we know the characteristic of the water, it was flowing. But that could just be an incidental. And I think it is. I think it's an incidental.
Yeah.
Okay? So we've got the rule of harmony. We've got the rule of materiality. Now let's think about the rule of uniformity. This is a little bit different. And he does describe other rules, and we'll talk about those next week. But he has a lot of other rules that we'll kind of talk about more quickly because they're not as involved as these. Rule of uniformity. When the New Testament records more than one case of a practice, and in every case the practice is the same, the example should be considered to be exclusive of other practices. Okay? Let me give you an example. In every case where we can determine who was being discussed, in every case, baptism was conditionally offered to those who were capable of believing or having faith in the gospel, where that can be determined. Okay? And in most cases, it's pretty easy because the person indicated that they had faith. So in every case of baptism where we can determine who the recipient of baptism was with a degree of certainty, it was always someone who was capable of belief. Okay, so my conclusion is the rule of uniformity would say because baptism is always presented this way, then that's exclusive. Can't be offered to people who can't believe. Manny?
No.
No comment? Okay. Anybody else? So I think this is my conclusion, based on this rule of uniformity, that baptism should not be administered in the case of someone who cannot believe. Now, who cannot believe? Yeah, Bill.
Well, to answer that question, what who's too young to understand right and wrong?
Okay.
Or someone who is mentally incapable of understanding.
Okay.
But
you had another question.
Yes, a question. No, a point. There is at least one place in the scriptures that says, he who believes and is baptized will be saved, or who he obeys is someone who believes. That excludes all others.
So that's going back to the rule of harmony. Okay. So where we can expand beyond the example to have information, rule of harmony would say you can't violate a precept with an example. Yeah, absolutely. Very good. And that's what I want us to start doing, is start thinking about these rules when we start thinking about examples. Other comments?
Babies don't need to be there.
Okay.
Saved already.
Okay, they've not sinned.
Yep, correct.
That's true.
Well, they wouldn't understand.
They're not capable of belief. Yeah. They've not sinned. They're not capable of belief. Therefore, baptism is not for a baby. And it's you know, it's never easy to get to the point where you say, at what age is baptism appropriate? Those are individual questions, and they have to be answered individually. Bill, you had a comment?
A question, yeah. The jailer who took the apostles and him and his household were baptized.
Or Cornelius, where he and his household were baptized.
Well, we know they were taught. The jailer, I don't think it says they were taught, does it?
Yeah, he took them out and they expound. He took them out of the jail and they talked to him about the gospel. Yeah, look at the case of the jailer, because then you would say you could be mistakenly implying that the apostles talked to the jailer and then the jailer and his household were baptized after the apostles talked to the head of the house.
I just didn't remember.
Yeah, that's one where you have to be really careful to read the whole illustration, the whole of the discussion. So the jailer took them out of the prison, fed them, probably took them to his place of residence, which in Roman times would have been right next to the prison. So the jailer took them out of the prison, took them to his residence. He fed them. They taught him the gospel, and he and his household. I don't know who was in the household. Okay. I just don't know. To say his household necessarily included people who were too young to believe is unwarranted. That's an assumption.
It doesn't say.
It doesn't say. The fact that...
But they don't need to be baptized.
I'm sorry?
But they don't need to be baptized if they're too young.
Yeah, it could be. And his household may not have included children. You don't know that. Because if you were to talk about my household right now, I have no children in my household. So that's one of those where there's just a confusion about who ought to be included in that. So I have to err on the side of caution and say, well, I don't know. But in every case where I can be certain who was discussed, then it was people that were capable of belief.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Mandy, you comment or just making a bid?
Oh, so many comments. so many, but it's a little heavy. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that, and we'll continue our discussion of Cogdell's discussion in lesson 5 in the book. And again, if you're interested in getting a hold of a copy of the book, they're available in the church's library. So we're talking about God's expectations of us. Those expectations are, I think, fairly clear. And those that I'm certain involve some question are still expectations that we can meet in one way or another. God's never asked us to do something that we can't do. And so we want to give you the opportunity to put Jesus on in baptism, if that's what you need to do tonight. And having put him on in baptism, if you wander away from him, we want to give you the opportunity to come back.